The minstrel Robbie Brennan sang three songs, each of them highly romanticized tales of Duncan McNeil's past, full of great adventures and daring escapes. But though they were unclear on whether Duncan had been a saint or a warrior, a mighty lover or a devoted family man, they all had one thing in common. All three songs were irredeemably awful. They were badly written, played with no style, and Brennan had the kind of singing voice that made you long for the sound of fingernails scraping down slate. He had the extremely irritating habit of shifting his voice up or down an octave when he couldn't reach the right note. Hawk's hatred of all minstrels, no matter how skilled, forced Fisher to physically restrain him by clinging determinedly but unobtrusively to his arm. Hawk also had a particular loathing for this kind of smug, cleaned-up song of hero worship. He usually tended to express this unhappiness by throwing the offending minstrel through the nearest window. Fisher, feeling strongly that this might not sit well with Jamie McNeil, clung firmly to Hawk's sword arm with both hands. Brennan finally ground to a halt and bowed more or less gracefully to his stunned audience. Hawk ground his teeth behind a fixed smile.
Applaud him, damn it.
Forget it. If we encourage him, he might do an encore. And I swear if I hear one more hey, nonny, no out of him, I'm going to ram his fingers up his nose till they stick out his ears.
Come, Robbie.
Katrina got the minstrel a drink, and the two of them stood chatting together. Jamie came back into the room and went over to join Hawk and Fisher. He checked to make sure Brennan wasn't watching, and then shook his head ruefully.
He's not very good, is he? Sorry to put you through that, but it's expected of me that I have me own minstrel. Family tradition and all that. Robbie was my father's minstrel, and I seem to have inherited him. He hasn't improved over the years. Father had cloth ears, but liked to sing, even though he couldn't carry a tune in a bucket. Robbie suited him very well. Besides, when all is said and done, he and Dad fought back-to-back on a dozen major campaigns when they were a lot younger. Least I can do is give Robbie a safe berth at the end of his days. I just wish I could convince him to retire.
He looked around as the butler Greaves ushered in two more guests. Hawk looked too, and his stomach lurched as though one of his feet had just slipped over the edge of a precipice. He knew one of the men in the doorway, and worse still, that man knew Captain Hawk. Jamie moved quickly over to greet the new arrivals, grinning broadly. Hawk struck his best aristocratic pose and smiled determinedly. It seemed he was about to find out just how good his disguise really was. Lord Arthur Sinclair smiled graciously at Jamie and strolled amiably forward into the drawing room, wine glass in hand, blinking vaguely about him. He was short, barely 5 feet tall, and sufficiently overweight so that he looked even shorter. He had a round, guileless face and smiled a lot at nothing in particular, but his uncertain blue eyes gave him a lost, confused look. He was in his mid-30s, with thinning yellow hair and the beginnings of a truly impressive set of jowls. He was also a drunk. He had no talents and no abilities, and thanks to his family, little or no self-esteem. He spent most of his time at parties, while the more conservative members of high society murmured darkly that he'd no doubt come to a bad end. To the surprise of everyone, not least himself, he'd inherited all his family's wealth, and for want of anything better to do, had spent the last few years trying to drink himself to death. All in all, he was making a pretty good job of it, the first and only time he'd made a success of anything. He'd dabbled occasionally in politics, just for the fun of it, and had briefly been a member of the infamous Hellfire Club, which was where Hawk had met him, while working on a case. Hawk tried not to feel too worried. Sinclair had been pretty drunk when they met, but then he usually was. Fisher, meanwhile, kept an eye on the other new arrival. Jamie had introduced him to the room at large as David Brooke, an old friend. Like most people in Haven, Fisher had heard of the Brooke family. They had a long tradition of high achievement in the Army and the Diplomatic Corps. To excel in one or the other was not unusual, but to excel in both was almost unheard of. Particularly in Haven, where diplomacy was usually just another way of sneaking up on an enemy when he wasn't looking. But that was the Brooks for you, brave and intelligent. A deadly combination. David himself was a brisk, heavyset man of slightly less than average height, well into his late 20s, and dressed impeccably, if somewhat gaudily, in the very latest fashion. He clapped Jamie companionably on the shoulder and strode forward to shake hands with the bemused Hawk. He lingered acceptably over Fisher's hand as he kissed it, and Fisher's smile widened approvingly, almost in spite of herself. David Brooke was devilishly handsome in a dark, swarthy way, and he knew it. He excused himself with polished regret and moved quickly over to join Holly. She smiled shakily at him with open relief, and for the first time that morning, some of the fear seemed to go out of her. She and David smiled and murmured together with the ease of long affection, their heads so close as to be almost touching. Lord Sinclair shook Hawk's hand and kissed Fisher's, smiling vaguely all the while, and then wandered over to join David and Holly, blinking owlishly as he waited to be noticed. They broke apart reluctantly, and Holly smiled at Sinclair with the kind of resigned affection usually reserved for puppies that are cute and lovable but only barely housebroken. As Jamie returned to top up Hawk's glass, he noticed Hawk's interest in Holly's admirers, and he raised an eyebrow.
Do you know David or Arthur?
No, but I have heard of Lord Arthur. I understand he likes his drink.
That's like saying a fish likes to swim. But you don't want to believe everything you hear. Arthur's a decent enough sort when you get to know him. He and David have always been close, and Holly and David have been practically engaged since they were 10. Childhood sweethearts and all that. And I'll say this for Arthur. He stuck by us when all our other so-called friends ran for cover.
He wouldn't be the first to find courage in a bottle.
Mark appeared, as usual, seemingly out of nowhere.
Probably too drunk and too foolish to be scared.
You think so?
Though his voice was polite, his eyes grew hard.
I know his sort.
No, you don't know him at all. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to consult with Greaves about breakfast.
He smiled at Hawk and Fisher, nodded briefly to Mark, and left. Hawk didn't blame him. Mark's voice had the kind of insensitive arrogance that would have had a saint's hands curling into fists. Fisher fixed Mark with a thoughtful stare.
You don't approve of Lord Arthur?
He's weak. I despise weakness. You have to be strong in this world or it'll grind you under.
We can't all be strong.
You don't have to be. You're beautiful. There'll always be someone ready to be strong for you.
He turned away, ignoring Hawk's glare, and went to stare out the wide window at the morning sunlight.
Calm yourself. We're supposed to be brother and sister, remember?
So I'm a very protective brother. Watch yourself with that one, Isabel. I don't trust him.
I don't trust any of them, but I take your point. Don't worry. I know how to handle his sort.
Hawk looked at her quickly.
We're quality now. If there's to be any rough stuff, I'll take care of it. You concentrate on being demure and ladylike.
Fisher raised an eyebrow, and Hawk had to smile.
Or at least as close as you can get.
Fisher gestured surreptitiously, and Hawk fell silent as Katrina Dorimant came over to join them. She nodded briefly to Fisher and then unleashed the full force of her smile on Hawk. It was a warm, intimate smile, suffused with promise, backed up by dark and unsettlingly direct eyes. Hawk smiled uncomfortably back, unconsciously standing a little taller and sucking in his gut. If Isabel hadn't been there, he might have just relaxed and enjoyed it, but as it was, he glanced at Isabel and was relieved to find she was smiling, apparently amused at his discomfort. Hawk decided he'd better play this very carefully. On the one hand, he couldn't afford to antagonize his host's aunt, but on the other hand, if Isabel stopped finding this funny long enough to get jealous, Hawk winced inwardly.
I'm so glad you're here, Richard.
Really?
Oh, yes. I was starting to think I'd have to spend this weekend all alone. I do so hate to be alone.
There are other guests here.
Katrina shrugged without taking her eyes off Hawk.
Alistair's too old. Arthur's too fat. David only has eyes for Holly. And Mark gives me the creeps. I don't like the way he looks at me. I'd begun to despair until you arrived, Richard.
I understand you're, separated from your husband.
That's right. My husband's Graham Dorimant, a sort of somebody in local politics. We're going to be divorced as soon as I can get the goods on him.
Hawk felt a strong inclination to turn and beat his head against the nearest wall. Was this case going to be nothing but one complication after another? Not only did he have to worry about Arthur Sinclair recognizing him, but now the woman who was making eyes at him turned out to be the estranged wife of someone else who knew him. Hawk and Fisher met Graham Dorimant on a previous case not all that long ago. If by some chance Graham discussed that case with Katrina, a sudden thought sobered Hawk like a rush of cold water. Hawk and Fisher made a great impression on Graham Dorimant. It could be that he described the two guards he met fully enough for Katrina to recognize them, even through their disguises. If so, what better way to distract them than by making a play for Hawk? But that assumed she had a reason for distracting them, which meant...
Breakfast will be served shortly in the dining room.
Everyone present moved toward the door. Katrina quickly latched onto Hawk's arm.
It's so good of you to escort me into breakfast, Richard. You will sit with me, won't you?
Well, I ought really to sit with my sister.
Oh, don't mind me. You enjoy yourself, Richard.
Breakfast won't be much, I'm afraid. Cook left 2 days ago, along with what was left of the kitchen staff. But Greaves and Robbie Brennan have been managing between them until the new staff arrive.
Hawk looked at her sharply.
Well, I thought you couldn't get servants to stay here because of the sightings.
This is Haven, Richard. Money can buy anything here. They won't be top-notch staff, of course, but they'll do. Until we can sort this mess out. Now, what was I saying? Oh, yes. Breakfast. Cold collation, I'm afraid. But I suppose I shouldn't complain. It's very good for my figure.
She glanced coquettishly at Hawk, obviously expecting a chivalrous reply. He was still trying to come up with an answer that was both polite and non-committal when they reached the dining room, at the end of the long, twisting corridor. The room was grand in design, if not in scale, most of it taken up by the single great table, which looked as though it could easily seat 30, and another dozen or so if everyone was feeling chummy. A magnificent white tablecloth lay half-hidden under the glistening silver service and 3 blazing candelabra. Everyone took seats at one end of the table with a minimum of fuss, and Hawk ended up with Katrina on one side and Fisher on the other. Arthur Sinclair sat opposite him. Hawk's heart missed a beat as that gentleman suddenly leaned forward and addressed him.
Tell me, Richard?
Yes.
Yes, Richard. Something I've been meaning to ask you. Why is your hair dark and your sister's yellow?
Mother was frightened by an albatross.
Lord Arthur blinked at him.
Oh.
He returned his attention to his wine glass. Hawk looked at the setting in front of him and panicked briefly as he found he didn't even recognize some of the more sophisticated cutlery. Start at the outside and work inwards, he told himself firmly, reaching for the outer knife and fork. Greaves and Robbie Brennan appeared through the swinging service door, carrying trays of cold meats and artfully arranged raw vegetables.
When you're ready, Greaves, do you think you could do something about the fire? It seems rather cold in here today.
Of course, sir.
Greaves gestured for Brennan to put his trays down on the table and see to the fire. Brennan gave him a look, but did as he was bid. For a while, there was only the occasional murmur of conversation as everyone heaped their plates and then set about the serious business of breakfast. Hawk in particular tucked into his food with gusto, but Mark, sitting opposite Fisher, seemed to be just toying with his. Hawk assumed he was one of those people who couldn't face a heavy meal first thing in the morning. Meanwhile, the minstrel had called on Greaves to help him get the fire going. Hawk smiled slightly. The butler obviously didn't care at all for being involved in such a menial task. He gave Brennan a hard look and then reached gingerly up into the chimney to tug at some obstruction. Whatever it was, it didn't want to budge, and Greaves had to try again, harder.
Go!
A body fell down out of the chimney and crashed onto the grate. It was a man, entirely naked, stained with soot, and very obviously dead. The whole of his face burned away by the fire. For a long moment, nobody stirred. Then everyone surged to their feet. Water was thrown on the fire, and the body was pulled from the ashes. Greaves backed away from the corpse, unable to take his eyes off it, until he bumped into the edge of the table behind him. Brennan stayed where he was, rooted to the spot.
Please, let me through.
Hawk pushed past them and knelt down beside the dead man. Jamie and Alistair crowded in behind him, peering over his shoulder, apparently unwilling to get any closer than that to the body. Fisher leaned gingerly into the fireplace and peered up the chimney, just in case it held any more nasty surprises. Everyone else huddled together at the far end of the table, torn between edging closer for a better look and making a mad dash for the door. Holly's face shone bone white, and she clung desperately to Katrina for support. Katrina patted her niece's hands in an absent-minded, comforting way while she craned her neck to see what was happening. David and Arthur both moved to put themselves between the ladies and the dead man, as much out of gallantry as anything. Mark stood beside them, gazing with fascination at the body. Hawk did his best to ignore Jamie and Alistair breathing down his neck and looked the dead man over carefully, starting at what was left of the head and working his way slowly down the body. There were a number of cuts and scrapes, presumably from being wedged up the chimney, but no sign of any death wound. He turned his attention back to the burned face and winced despite himself. The eyes and nose were gone, and the teeth grinned horribly through a mask of charred flesh and bone. No hair remained, and the ears were nothing more than blackened nubs. Hawk breathed shallowly through his mouth, trying to avoid the smell. He'd seen many dead men in his time, even in worse condition than this, but there was something disturbingly cold and calculating in the manner of this man's death. He touched the man's shoulder gently with his fingertips. The flesh was cold to the touch, already showing the purplish bruises caused by blood sinking to the lowest part of the body. The dead man had been in the chimney for some time, maybe overnight. Hawk tried the neck, but it didn't seem to be broken. He worked the dead man's arm gently, and it bent easily at the elbow, indicating rigor mortis either hadn't set in yet or had been and gone. Hawk frowned. That was probably a clue as to how long the man had been dead, but he didn't understand such things. He'd never needed to. That was what forensic sorcerers were for. He looked around sharply as Jamie McNeil crouched down beside him. Alistair leaned in closer, one hand resting supportively on Jamie's shoulder.
How did he die, do you think?
Hard to tell. There's no actual death wound that I can see, just the damage to the face.
Alistair leaned in closer.
Nasty way to go. I once knew a tribe of savages who killed their prisoners this way. Hung them over an open fire till their brains boiled. Nasty.
I don't think that's what happened here. Look at the back of the head.
He gingerly lifted the burned head off the floor so they could see.
The face has been totally destroyed, but the back of the head is barely touched. I think someone pushed this poor bastard's face into the fire and held it there till he died.
Oh, gods!
Jamie looked suddenly as though he might vomit and turned his head away, eyes squeezed shut.
There's no sign of any struggle here, as far as I can see.
Fisher's voice floated from inside the chimney. She ducked her head back out and beat soot from her hair and shoulders.
Looks to me like he was already dead when the killer stuffed him up the chimney.
She started toward the group around the body, but Alistair moved quickly to block her way.
That's quite close enough, my dear. Please return to the others. This is no sight for a young lady such as yourself.
Fisher was about to ask sarcastically whether he was referring to the dead man's injuries or his nakedness when she caught Hawk glaring at her. At which point she remembered she was supposed to be a sheltered young flower of the quality, not a hardened city guard. She went reluctantly back to join the others. She put a comforting arm around Holly's shaking shoulders and listened carefully to what was being said about the dead man.
Any idea who this is, or rather was?
The McNeil looked back at the body. His face was very pale, but his gaze was steady and his mouth was firm.
Whoever he is, he shouldn't be here. The last of the servants left 2 days ago, and the only guests I know of are all in this room.
Maybe one of the servants came back.
Not without Greaves knowing, and he would have told me. None of this makes any sense. No one could have got past this tower's wards without setting off all kinds of alarms. It's impossible. And who would want to kill a man here in, like, that? It's insane.
Alistair gripped Jamie's shoulder firmly.
Easy, lad. Don't go to pieces on us now. You're the McNeil. And the others will be looking to you for guidance. We have a murderer loose in the tower somewhere, and we have to find him before he strikes again.
He's right. This is a very nasty business, Jamie. You better call in the guard.
No! This is a family matter. We don't bring outsiders into family business.
Hawk got to his feet and stared at Alistair.
What century are you living in? You can't keep the guard out of something like this. This is murder we're talking about, not who put some chambermaid up the stick. Our best bet is to get the hell out of here, send for the guard, and then block off all the exits till they get here. Let them find the killer. They're experts.
I'm afraid it's not that simple.
Jamie rose to his feet.
I've already raised the final wards. I did it just now, so that we could get on with the reading of the will. I never thought... The wards can't be lowered for another 24 hours. And that's the way they're designed. I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. None of us can leave the tower.
David Brooks stepped forward, staring disbelievingly at Jamie.
Are you saying that we're all trapped in here with a killer? That whatever happens, there's no way out.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
He looked at Hawk, who was frowning down at the body.
What is it, Richard?
Well, I was just wondering why the killer took the time to strip the body naked. Presumably, the killer didn't want us to be able to identify the victim. Which suggests that at least one of us would have recognized him. That explains the burned face as well.
Something else to think about. That body had been wedged quite a way up the chimney, going by the traces I found. Whoever the killer is must be pretty strong. It can't have been easy, stuffing a limp, dead body feet first up a chimney.
Several of the others looked quite disturbed by Fisher's remark.
The man must have been mad. Madmen are supposed to be incredibly strong, aren't they?
Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us, Isabel, but I really feel you and the other lady should withdraw. This is not a subject suitable for your tender ears.
No, I don't want anyone going off on their own. Unless they like the idea of being an easy target. Until we know what the hell's going on here, we do better to stick together. There's safety in numbers.
Jamie looked at him strangely.
You sound almost as though you've had experience with this sort of thing before, Richard.
Being called Richard brought Hawk up short as he remembered who he was supposed to be. He shrugged, thinking quickly.
There was a murder at one of the inns Isabel and I stayed at on our way here. I did a lot of thinking about it afterwards and all the sensible things I should have done. But you're the McNeil, Jamie, and this is your home. You're in charge. I wasn't trying to usurp your authority.
No, don't be daft. This is all new to me. If you've got any ideas on what we ought to be doing, speak out.
Well, to start with, I think we should get back to the drawing room. I don't think we ought to move the body, and we can't hope to discuss this mess sensibly while it's lying right there in front of us.
Robbie Brennan looked at Hawk with unbelieving eyes.
Are you saying we should just leave the body here?
Why not? It's not going anywhere.
At least cover him! Give the poor man some dignity.
And just what are we supposed to cover him with? I'm afraid I didn't think to bring a shroud with me to breakfast.
Maybe someone could fetch a cloak from the main hall.
No! You heard, Richard. It's not safe for anyone to go off on their own.
We can't just leave the man like this. He's got to be covered decently.
Fisher grabbed one end of the magnificent white tablecloth and gave it a good hard jerk. Food, china, cutlery, and flowers went flying in all directions. The candelabra collapsed and rivers of spilled wine cascaded over the sides of the table as she kept pulling. The last of the tablecloth finally came free, and Fisher draped it roughly over the dead man. Jamie stared speechlessly at the mess she'd made, and then looked at her. She smiled back at him.
Can we get the hell out of here now? This place makes me nervous. Besides, I need a good stiff drink, and all the good brandies are back in the drawing room.
Hawk fought to keep the smile off his lips. He should have known Fisher wouldn't be able to keep up the demure young lady pose for long. He supposed he should be grateful that at least she hadn't hit anyone yet.
If we're going to move, let's move. If nothing else, I think we'll be safer in the drawing room. It's a lot easier to defend than this place. There are too many doors here for my liking.
Good thinking, lad. The drawing room's only got one door, and we can barricade that if necessary.
Katrina's hand rose unsteadily to her mouth, and her eyes widened.
You mean the murderer might try and attack us?
It's possible. We don't know what we're dealing with yet.
I think you're all worrying needlessly. This is one man we're talking about, not an army. If worst comes to worst, there are more than enough of us here to overpower him.
It might not be that simple. There's only one man who could have done something like this. The freak. He got out after all these years, and he wants revenge. Revenge on the family that walled him up alive.
Silence fell across the dining room as they all looked at each other, the tension almost crackling on the air. Hawk silently cursed the young McNeil. He'd already worked out that the freak was most likely the murderer, but he'd wanted the others safely back in the drawing room before he told them. The last thing he needed was a panic here. Everyone's eyes shot to him.
It'll be time to discuss all this later. Right now, I want everyone concentrating on getting back to the drawing room safely.
What gives you the right to give everyone orders? Why should we listen to you?
Because he's talking sense. All right, Richard. Let's take a look out in the corridor. Make sure it's clear.
The two of them moved over to the main door, eased it open a crack, then took turns peering out down the corridor. Nothing moved in the clear morning light, and the few shadows were comfortably small. Jamie looked at Hawk.
How do you want to do this, Richard?
First thing, all the men draw their swords, just in case. I'll go first, then you and Alistair. The women will come after us, with the rest of the men bringing up the rear.
He looked back at the others and gave them his best reassuring smile.
Well, there's no reason for anyone to be worried. Now, we're just taking sensible precautions, that's all.
None of them looked particularly convinced. Hawk gave up on the smile. He'd always done better with a glare than a smile. He looked at Jamie for help, and the McNeil quickly got everyone moving. Hawk nodded approvingly. Jamie had the right touch, that particular mixture of arrogance and charm that was the hallmark of the aristocracy. Hawk led them out into the corridor and headed back to the drawing room at a carefully unhurried pace. It wouldn't do to take it too quickly. Most of them were so rattled they'd break into a run first chance they got. That would be a real recipe for disaster. Once they were all just running wildly, the freak could pick any one of them off without being noticed. So Hawk strode along at a casual pace, carefully checking each turn of the corridor as he came to it. Luckily, he had a good head for direction, unlike Isabel. She could get lost going to the Jakes in a strange inn, and had done before now. The corridor seemed subtly different than it had the last time he'd walked it. The light grew dimmer as they left the windows behind them and came to depend more and more on the wall lamps. The shadows grew darker and larger, and it was easy to imagine something cruel and menacing waiting patiently in the darkness for them to pass. Every door was a potential threat, every turn in the corridor a potential trap. The quiet seemed increasingly sinister, broken only by the soft scuffling and shuffling of their feet on the polished floor. Hawk hefted the light dueling sword in his hand and wished more than ever for his axe. He scowled furiously as he tried to figure out what to do next. The last time he and Fisher had been trapped in an isolated house with a group of guests and a killer on the loose, things went terribly wrong. He and Fisher put a stop to the killings eventually, but not before too many innocent people died. Hawk's frown deepened. He was damned if he'd let that happen again. He tensed and lifted his sword as someone came up alongside him, but it was only Alistair.
Hold your water, lad. It's just me. Wanted to congratulate you on how you're handling things. You've had military experience, haven't you?
Actually, no. I know it's not really my place to be taking charge and giving orders, but everyone else seemed too shaken. And there were things that needed to be done. We weren't safe in the dining room.
You'll get no arguments from me on that, lad. I haven't felt easy in the tower since I arrived. Place feels secretive. But do you really think the freak is that dangerous? He's only one man.
I don't know. He's a mystery. And I don't like mysteries. When you get right down to it, the freak is most dangerous because he doesn't fit any normal pattern. Most murders involve people who know each other. People who kill either for business reasons or in the heat of passion. But we're dealing with someone who's spent centuries in solitary confinement, building his madness year by year and honing his hate to a cutting edge. He could do anything for any reason. Which means we haven't a hope in hell of outthinking him. All we can do is stack the odds in our favor as much as we can.
Very sensible.
Alistair looked thoughtfully at Hawk.
No offense, Richard, but you do seem to know an uncommon lot about murders and murderers. Mind telling me how you came by that knowledge?
Of course not. There's not much to do in Lower Markham, so I read a lot. Crime fascinates me, especially murders. So that's what I read about, mostly.
Alistair made no comment, just nodded and dropped back to rejoin Jamie. It wasn't the best answer he could have come up with, but then thinking on his feet had never been what he did best, except when he was fighting. But he was going to have to be more careful. He had to think like a guard if he was going to solve this case, but he couldn't afford to act like one. If Jamie found out, he'd revealed his family's darkest secret to an outsider, and a city guard at that. There was a collective sigh of relief as they reached the drawing room without incident. Hawk was first in and quickly checked that the room was secure. He then ushered the others in and checked the door for bolts. There weren't any, so he wedged a chair up against the door and settled for that. In a situation like this, looking out for yourself was tiring enough without having to worry about a bunch of civilians, half of whom were jumping at their own damn shadows. They were already splitting up into smaller groups, turning to those they trusted most for comfort and support. Jamie and Alistair were talking urgently together, with a fair amount of arm-waving from both of them. David Brooke and Lord Arthur were trying to help Katrina soothe Holly, who was still trembling pitifully. Mark stood with them, holding a drink for Holly, his face as calm and composed as ever. Hawk studied him for a moment, frowning thoughtfully. Of them all, Mark had coped best with the situation. He might well prove a useful ally if things started getting out of control. Whatever else you could say about Mark, the man had guts. Hawk looked away, and his gaze settled on Brennan and Greaves. They were standing patiently together, not far from Jamie and Alistair, waiting for orders. Fisher came over to join Hawk with a snifter of brandy in each hand. Hawk accepted his gratefully.
Well, how do you read this? What the hell is going on here?
You got me. What little evidence there is points in half a dozen different directions at once. I did some thinking on the way here, and I've managed to narrow it down to three main possibilities. First, and most obvious, is that the freak really has got loose and has graduated from breaking up the furniture to killing people. It doesn't explain who the dead stranger is, though, or why the freak chose him as his first victim rather than one of us.
Second choice, equally obvious. This is all something to do with the spy Fenris. Perhaps the dead man was going to be Fenris's contact, and someone killed him to prevent that contact from taking place? Or the dead man could be Fenris, killed by his contact for screwing up his mission. That would explain why the man's face was burned away, so that we wouldn't be able to tell who Fenris really was.
And finally, there's choice number three. Someone in this room is a murderer, and killed that man for personal reasons that have nothing to do with Fenris or the freak.
And as if this case wasn't complicated enough, we now have a murder mystery on our hands. All right, what do? Reveal who we are and take charge?
Are you crazy? The penalty for impersonating Quality is death by dismemberment, remember? Besides, we don't dare risk our cover until we've got some kind of lead on which of these people is Fenris. Our orders were to prevent Fenris escaping, no matter what. We're going to have to do what sleuthing we can undercover and keep our ideas to ourselves.
That shouldn't be too difficult. I haven't got two ideas to rub together.
Then you haven't been paying attention. We already know Alistair isn't being honest about where he comes from.
We do?
Fisher looked at him sternly.
You're showing off again, Richard. All right, what did I miss this time?
Hawk couldn't keep all of the smile off his lips.
According to Alistair, he comes from the Red Marches. He grew almost lyrical about the marvelous countryside and the good hunting to be found there. But we passed through the Red Marches on our way to Haven 7 years ago. They've been flooded for the past 80 years. Most of the land is underwater now. There's some good fishing here and there, but no hunting. He also talked about getting involved in fighting down on the border, but thanks to the floods, it's been peaceful down there for years. It's the most secure border in the Low Kingdoms these days. But Alistair didn't know that. Interesting, eh?
Very. But why didn't any of the others pick up on it?
The Red Marches are pretty remote and about as far from high society as you can get. It's probably just a name to most people here, which is probably what Alistair was counting on.
I'll tell you who else we ought to keep an eye on, and that's Katrina. She's still married to Graham Dormant, who was heavily involved in the local political scene. Since they're separated now, and not at all amicably, it's just possible she might have got involved in outsider politics as a way of getting back at her husband. She could be Fenris's contact. She's been here at the tower for some time. That could explain why Fenris went to ground here.
But if he's already met his contact, why hasn't he left?
Perhaps he's waiting for her to arrange a safe route out.
Well, hold your horses. There's another possibility, and one we should have spotted sooner. What if the dead man had been Fenris's contact, and had threatened to abandon Fenris to the authorities rather than risk any more of the outsider network being discovered? Fenris must know he's facing a death penalty, even if he is Quality. He could have killed his contact to protect himself and then hidden the body while he tried to figure out what to do next.
Right, but he waited too long, and Jamie put the wards up. We've got to identify him before tomorrow, Hawk, or he'll run the moment the wards go down.
Isabel, will you please call me Richard? Walls have ears, you know, especially in a situation like this.
Sorry, but if Fenris is our killer, it means we have to stop wasting time looking for some imaginary murderous freak. I mean, what proof have we got that the creature ever existed, apart from Jamie's story?
We've seen stranger things in our time.
On the other side of the room, Jamie looked at Alistair almost pleadingly.
We can talk about Richard and Isabel later, Alistair. I have more important things to worry about. What am I going to do about the killing?
Calm down. Getting hysterical won't help. Let's look at this logically. Now that we know the freak's a killer, what matters most is tracking it down before it strikes again. Which means we have to find the hidden cell. We'll search the tower from top to bottom, checking each room as we go for hidden panels and secret passages. If the freak got out of his room, there must be a way in. We can split into two groups to save time. I'll take one group, you lead the other. Right?
Yes, right.
The panic that had all but paralyzed him was dropping swiftly away now that he had a definite goal to focus on. He smiled quickly at Alistair and looked around him.
There is no point in taking everyone with us. The women will be safer here, out of harm's way.
We'd better leave Lord Arthur behind as well.
Alistair's gaze was unyielding.
I think he means well, but you can't trust a drunk in a crisis. What about David Brooke? Good man?
The best. Good with a sword, level-headed, and doesn't scare easily. Always knows the right thing to do in a tricky situation. I'd trust him with my life. We'll take Greaves, too. He's another steady one, utterly dependable. As for Robbie Brennan, he's a stout enough man and damned good with a sword in his younger days, from what Dad used to say. But that was long ago.
Once a soldier, always a soldier. The old instincts will still be there. Just need the right moment to bring them out again.
If you say so. Now what about Mark?
He's a cool one, I'll give him that. But I don't know if I'd trust him to guard my back. Still, he doesn't look the type to fold under pressure. And that just leaves Richard. And you know how I feel about him.
He seems a solid enough sort. Somewhat gauche and a bit of a bumpkin, but this is his first trip to the big city, after all. And he was the one who got us all organized when everyone else fell apart at the sight of the body.
Exactly. I've seen a good many dead men in my time, but even so, what was left of that poor bastard's face stopped me in my tracks. It didn't throw Richard, though. He was right there, examining the body and cracking out orders. It's not natural, Jamie. And when I asked him about it, do you know what he said? He said murders fascinate him, so he spends all his time reading about them. Never trust a man who reads, Jamie. It gives him ideas. The wrong sort of ideas.
Yeah, maybe. But right now he seems to be the only one of us who knows what he's doing. He goes with us. If only so, we can keep a close eye on him.
I don't trust him. He's hiding something.
Everyone has something to hide. All that matters right now is finding the freak before he kills again. This is my home. Whatever happened through the years, I always felt safe and secure here. Freak's taken that away from me, and I want it back.
Alistair dropped a heavy hand on Jamie's shoulder.
Buck up, lad. We'll find the freak and kill him. And then things will get back to normal again. You'll see.
Greaves looked disapprovingly at Robbie Brennan as the minstrel helped himself to a second large snifter of brandy.
Look at the state of you. I don't know which makes your hands shake the more, the fear or the drink. The young master will have need of us soon, and he'll be none too pleased if he finds you the worse for drink. Get a hold of yourself, man.
Go to hell. You're a cold fish, Greaves, and always have been. I've never seen an honest emotion cross that cold face of yours in all the years I've known you. It's always been, yes, sir, no, sir. Can I wipe your ass now, sir? I've been with this family for 40 years, long before you came along. But I've always been my own man.
Greaves looked at him unflinchingly.
Is this leading anywhere?
When I was a man-at-arms in the Broken Flats campaign, I saw more dead men than you could imagine in your worst nightmare. I saw them cut down and ripped apart and piled up in huge heaps under the midday sun. And I never got used to it. Which is why I came out of that campaign sane when a lot of men didn't. Duncan would have understood. It's enough to be strong when you have to be. He never expected a man to be always unmoved and unfeeling. Like you. So right now, we've got a freak running loose in a tower out for revenge on all of us. But I bet at the end of the day, I'll be standing and you'll be crawling on your knees. Because I know when to bend with the wind, and you don't.
You always did have a way with words. But then that's all you've got left now, isn't it? Your soldier days were a long time ago. Look at you. Shaking and quivering in every nerve, with your snout buried in your glass, and Mr. Duncan was always so proud of you, and saying what a fine warrior you were on the battlefield. What would he say if he could see you now?
Duncan would have understood.
Brennan straightened up a little.
I'll do my bit. You worry about yourself.
It's not myself that fills my thoughts, Robbie Brennan. And what worries I have are not for you. It's the young master, the McNeil himself, that we should be concerned about. He had no choice but to reveal the great secret to all those people. But it must not pass beyond these walls. If it were to get out, the McNeil would be ruined. It's up to us to make sure that doesn't happen.
Just what are you suggesting, Greaves?
What I am suggesting, Robbie Brennan, minstrel and sometime friend to the McNeil family, is that we make sure only those we can trust leave this tower alive.
If Jamie knew what you were saying.
He is not to know. It is our job to protect this family and do what must be done for its safety. The McNeil is too young to understand.
They looked at each other for a long moment until Brennan finally nodded and put down his empty glass. Holly accepted a snifter of brandy from Lord Arthur and nodded her thanks. Her hands were steadying and some color was finally coming back into her cheeks. She smiled briefly around her and then lowered her head again.
I'm sorry. I'm not usually like this. It's the shock.
It's all right. We understand.
David Brooke watched the pair with growing annoyance.
There's no need to hover over her like that, Arthur. Give the poor girl room to breathe.
Arthur nodded quickly and stepped back a pace. Holly gripped his hand firmly and reached out to take David's hand, too.
Please, don't argue. I'm feeling better now. Let's get out of here. We can stay with friends in the city.
We can't leave just now, pet. You heard your brother. The wards are up. We can't leave the tower till tomorrow morning. But we're perfectly safe here. Nothing can get to us.
It'll be all right, Holly. I won't let anyone hurt you.
David shot him an exasperated look and turned back to Holly.
We'll look after you, darling. It's obvious who the killer is. It's that damn freak Jamie told us about earlier. All we have to do is track him down.
No, that's too dangerous. He might kill you.
Holly gripped his hand hard, as though to physically restrain him from leaving. David smiled and patted her hand comfortingly.
There's nothing to worry about. The freak doesn't stand a chance against all of us. Isn't that right, Arthur? Mark.
Arthur smiled and nodded vigorously. Mark turned and looked at them directly for the first time.
We don't know for sure that the freak is the killer. We have no hard evidence, one way or the other. The killer could be anyone. Perhaps even one of us.
There was a long pause as that sank in, and then, one by one, the others began looking around the room, their gaze lingering on some faces longer than others.
After all, what do we really know about each other? Even the most ordinary person can do terrible things under the right conditions. People you've known for years can become strangers in a moment, transfigured by a single insight or a hidden motive. Who is there you can really trust when you come right down to it? Some days you can't even trust yourself.
You have to trust someone, and better a friend than a stranger. Take yourself, for instance. We don't know a single thing about you except for what you've chosen to tell us. You could have all kinds of secrets for all we know.
Oh, honestly, Arthur, if Mark did have something to hide, he wouldn't have brought up the subject in the first place, would he? You'll have to excuse Arthur, Mark. His mouth tends to say things before his brain can catch up. Anyway, I think you're barking up the wrong tree, dear. I've known Jamie and David and Arthur for years, and they don't have a malicious bone in their bodies. As for Alistair, that's different. He claims to be just a distant cousin, but he seems to know an awful lot about family history. He knows things even I didn't know.
I wish the Guardian were here. I prayed for him to come.
Yes, dear, we know, but you shouldn't take family myths so seriously. Most of them are just legends and fireside tales that have grown in the telling.
The Frick turned out to be real, so why not the Guardian too?
Personally, I have to say I've got a few doubts about Richard. He seems awfully full of himself for a minor cousin from Lower Markham. I didn't even know the family had branches up there in that part of the world. And what about you, Mark? You ever run across either Richard or Isabel before?
Never. Their arrival here was a complete surprise to me.
Now, don't you dare start picking on Richard, just because he comes from Lower Markham. We've always known that some parts of the family have gone down in the world. And remember, he's one of the few people to stick by us, even after he found out about the secret.
Yes, interesting that. Why should he and his sister be so loyal? Why come all this way, with winter so close?
Presumably, he expects Duncan to make it worth his while in the will.
Could be, but that might not be his only motive.
What other motive could he have?
Why don't we ask him?
Yes, why don't we?
But just then, Jamie strode forward into the middle of the room.
Friends, may I have your attention, please? My friends, I regret to say it, but we can't simply barricade ourselves in here and wait for the wards to go down tomorrow morning. We have a duty and an obligation to find the freak and put an end to its miserable existence.
But no one's been able to find the bricked-up room for centuries.
I've been thinking about that problem, and I've come up with an idea. Based on certain comments and internal evidence in the notes my father left, I'm pretty sure the freak cell is some kind of window. Presumably not very large, but enough to allow light to enter. So I propose we make a tour of the tower. Floor by floor, opening every window and hanging out a marker of some kind until we've covered them all. Then we go outside and take a look. Whichever window remains unmarked has to be the freak's cell. Shouldn't be too difficult to find the room with that to point the way.
It might just work. It's simple and straightforward. I like it.
Wait a minute. Did you say go outside the tower? I thought we were all trapped in here by the wards.
The wards do not become operative until some 10 feet beyond the tower. And no, I don't know why. The wards themselves were designed hundreds of years ago. I just raise and lower them as and when needed. Now, if there are no more questions, I think we should make a start.
Obviously, we can't all go. The women will have to stay here. And someone will have to remain with them to protect them.
Right. And the smaller the search party, the better. No point in risking anyone we don't have to. The freak could be out there anywhere, just waiting for a chance at us. This has to be volunteers only, and people who can look after themselves in a fight. I'll go, for one. Who's with me?
You do like to take charge, don't you, Richard?
Sorry, I'm just eager to make a start. But, of course, you're in charge. You're the McNeil.
That's right. I am. So I'll decide who goes and who stays. Since you're so eager, Richard, you can be part of the group, along with Alistair and myself. How about you, Arthur? You any good with a sword?
Not really. Sorry, Jamie, I'm not really up to heroics. But I'll do my best to protect the ladies while you're gone.
I'd better stay too. There ought to be one person here who knows one end of his sword from the other.
I'll go with you, Jamie. I'm fairly proficient with the sword, and I hate being cooped up.
Mr. Brennan and I will be happy to accompany you, sir.
Greaves stepped forward with the minstrel. Jamie smiled but shook his head.
No offense, but I think we'll make better time without you.
As you wish.
Don't sulk, Robbie. It doesn't become you. I'd take you if I could, but speed is of the essence, and I think you'll be more useful here. In the meantime, barricade the door behind us once we've gone. Make it sturdy enough to keep the freak out, but not so heavy you can't dismantle it fast if we need to get back in here in a hurry. Well, no point in hanging about, is there? We might as well go, unless there's anything you want to add, Richard.
I don't think so, Jamie. You've covered everything I can think of.
Then let's go. We've got a lot of ground to cover.
Hawk pulled the chair away from the door, listened a moment, and then carefully eased the door open. A quick glance up and down the corridor revealed nothing but familiar furniture and the occasional shadow. Everything stood still and silent. He stepped out into the corridor, sword in hand, followed by Jamie and Alistair and Mark. Once the door closed behind them, the furniture was piled against it. Hawk looked at Jamie for orders, and Jamie hesitated a long moment before nodding to the left. They set off down the corridor, alert for any sudden sound or movement. Despite all that had taken place, it was still early in the day, and the corridor was bathed in bright golden sunlight. From an open window, Hawk could hear gulls keening and the distant crash of waves on the rocks far below. Jamie moved over to the window and draped one of the curtains so that it hung out over the windowsill. They continued on down the corridor, swords at the ready, keeping a careful eye on every door they passed. The quiet grew heavy and oppressive, and Hawk's skin prickled uneasily. He hadn't liked breaking up the group, but he could see Jamie was determined to have his way, so he went along with it. But he still didn't feel right about it. The last time he'd been in a situation like this had been in the Sorcerer Gaunt's house. People insisted on going off on their own despite everything Hawk and Fisher did to stop them. Most of them died horribly. He was damned if he'd let that happen again. But there were limits to what he could do in Tower McNeil. Jamie wasn't about to let him take control of the situation, no matter what. Richard was a minor cousin from Lower Markham and should accordingly know his place and keep his mouth shut. Hawk had never been very good at that. He hefted his sword unhappily as they walked along. With only one eye left, Hawk's depth perception was shot to hell, and his swordsmanship was only a shadow of what it had once been. It didn't affect him so much with the axe. An axe has many qualities and virtues all its own, but subtlety isn't one of them. With an axe, as long as you can see your opponent, you can usually hit him. And a man who's been hit with an axe does not grit his teeth and fight back, as sometimes happens with a sword wound. A man hit solidly by an axe tends rather more to being thrown to the ground with the impact, bleeding copiously and screaming for his mother. Admittedly, an axe isn't much use as a defensive weapon, but Hawk never believed in fighting defensively. He was much more comfortable with an all-out attack, backed up by dirty tricks. Hawk looked disgustedly at the narrow dueling sword in his hand. If it came to a fight, he'd probably be better off throwing the damn thing like a spear.
God.
He scowled and then winced as a stab of pain flared up around his glass eye. The damn things always made his face ache after a while. The last doctor he saw told him the pain was all in his mind, to which Hawk angrily retorted that it was all in the eye socket, and what was the doctor going to do about it? The doctor recommended a change to a less stressful occupation and presented Hawk with an inflated bill that Hawk refused to pay. The tour of the ground floor occurred without incident. The group left the windows marked, and there was no sign of the freak anywhere. The large rooms, designed for entertaining, were easy to search, and the open, well-lit corridors offered few hiding places. Jamie led the group up the curving stairs to the first floor, which was mainly bedchambers and bathrooms. Everything was still and quiet, the only sound, their own echoing footsteps. Hawk felt like a child sneaking through his parents' quarters while they were out. The endless quiet and occasional false alarms began to gnaw at Hawk's nerves, but he just shrugged it off and kept going. He had to set a good example to the others, who were all starting to show signs of strain. Jamie was getting jumpy and showed an increasing tendency to check things twice or even three times before he was satisfied. Alistair's scowl was deepening, and he'd taken to hefting his sword impatiently, as though anxious for a confrontation. And Mark had withdrawn so far into himself he seemed to be walking alone through the empty corridors. The rooms were lavishly appointed and would have interested Hawk greatly under different circumstances, but as it was, each gorgeously finished room blended into another as the tour continued. The first floor passed in a blur of empty rooms and silent, deserted corridors, and they made their way up the stairs to the second floor. Hawk began to wonder if they'd underestimated the freak. They'd all been talking about him as though he were nothing more than an animal, all instinct and ferocity. But that was wrong.
The freak is a man, and cunning enough to hide his dead victim so the body wasn't found till hours after the murder. I don't like it. We may be doing exactly what the freak wants, wasting time trying to find his lair while he plans ways of attacking us, or those we left behind.
The second floor consisted of servants' quarters, clean and fairly comfortable, but essentially nondescript. The only exceptions were Greaves's and Brennan's rooms. The butler's room had a bleak simplicity that suggested he spent as little time there as possible. Everything was neatly lined up and squared off as though for inspection, and Hawk knew without having to be told that woe would betide any maid who moved anything an inch out of place while dusting. Brennan's quarters, on the other hand, were littered with a lifetime's collection of keepsakes and souvenirs, most of them military in nature. There were daggers and swords mounted on the walls, and trinkets and mementos brought back from a dozen campaigns. Hawk looked them over briefly and frowned as he realized how dated they were. It was as though Brennan's life came to an abrupt halt when he came to the tower. That there was nothing from his new life worth the keeping. The third floor was storage. Endless storerooms packed with the accumulated clutter of generations of MacNeils. Few of the rooms had any windows beyond the narrowest arrow slits, but Jamie marked them as best he could, and they moved on. They tramped wearily up the final set of stairs and stepped out onto the open battlements. The cold wind blew away the cobwebs of fatigue from Hawk's mind. The view was magnificent, from the dark, labyrinthine sprawl of Haven to the great jagged cliffs surrounding it, to the vast expanse of the open sea. Gulls hung in the sky far above them, keening on the rising wind like lost souls banned from heaven or hell. Hawk felt he could stand there forever, just drinking in the view. Alistair gazed about him with obvious nostalgia, while Jamie was predictably blasé, having seen it all before. Mark, on the other hand, looked once at the sea and at the cliffs and turned away, apparently uninterested. And then he looked out over Haven, and couldn't tear his gaze away. Hawk shrugged inwardly. No accounting for taste.
We'd best get back to the others.
Finally, Jamie led them back down through the tower to the ground floor. There was still no sign of the freak anywhere, and Hawk could sense they were all beginning to relax a little. The general feeling seemed to be that the freak would have attacked them by now if he was going to.
I don't trust the feeling. The freak is up to something. Something so obvious I can't see it for looking. It's as though the freak doesn't care whether we find his lair or not. He must have found a better place to hide.
Yeah.
Hawk scowled ferociously as Jamie led them through the entrance hall and out the main door. The gusting wind caught Hawk's attention again, and he looked around him. Even after the unobscured view from the battlements, he'd still been half expecting to see some shimmering, mystical barrier cutting the tower off from the rest of the world. But everything seemed perfectly normal. The cliff edge stretched away before him, and the wind ruffled the long grass on either side of the trail that led back down to Haven. A sudden thought struck him. He only had Jamie's word for it that the wards were actually there. If by some chance Jamie himself was the spy's contact, what better way to draw attention away from himself and Fenris than by concocting the story of the murderous freak? Or could Jamie be Fenris? Either way, it would explain why the spy had headed straight for Tower MacNeil. But on the other hand, if the freak was real and the wards were real, that would have thrown the spy completely off balance. Being trapped in the tower by the wards would have been the last thing he'd expected. He'd have to be getting pretty desperate by now. and desperate men make mistakes. Hawk pursed his lips thoughtfully. So it all came down to whether the wards were actually there. Either way, the answer to that question would tell him something important. Unless Fenris let the freak out for some reason.
I'm not going to think about it anymore for a while. It's all getting too complicated. All that matters for the moment is checking whether the wards are actually there.
Hawk walked casually forward.
Richard! Stop!
Jamie came running up behind him to grab him by the arm.
Don't go near the wards, Richard! It isn't safe!
Jamie bent down, picked up a clump of grass, and threw it forward. It flew a few feet and then flared up suddenly, burning with a brilliant eye-searing flame. Within seconds, there were only a few particles of ash carried away on the wind. Jamie wiped his hands on a handkerchief, then tucked it neatly away in his sleeve.
Sorry about that, Richard. I should have warned you.
That's all right. I wasn't thinking. Thank you.
They both turned away from the wards and joined the others in circling around the tower, searching for an empty window. Curtains and clothing and other markers flapped fitfully at the many windows and arrow slits.
There! Look there!
Jamie spotted an unmarked window.
I'm there!
And there as well.
The four men stood quietly together a moment, looking at the tower and each other.
Three? How the hell can there be three windows?
Presumably there are two more hidden rooms.
And with our luck, two more freaks.
Please, Richard, don't say that. Not even as a joke. Things are bad enough without tempting fate. No, whatever those rooms are, they can't have anything to do with the freak. Or Dad would have mentioned them in his notes.
Not necessarily.
We're wasting time. The quickest way to find out why there are two more hidden rooms is to go and take a look.
He's right. We have to know what's in those rooms. One of them's got to have the answers we need.
Very well. Let's go. All three rooms are on the third floor. They shouldn't be too difficult to find.